Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Ethnographic Marginalia, a special series on the New Books Network. I'm Sneha Anavarapu.
And I'm Alex Diamond.
And we are the hosts of this special series.
Ethnographic Marginalia brings together a set of conversations around ethnographic practice. In each episode, we will converse with an ethnographer about their research design, process, and fieldwork experiences.
This special series centers the dilemmas, tribulations, mistakes, and pleasures that go into doing ethnographic research. We hope to use the conversations that transpire on this podcast as an opportunity to build community amongst ethnographers in various disciplines.
Towards this end, we also have a website where we publish field notes, ethnographic essays, photo essays, and methodological reflections.
Please visit our website, Ethnographic Marginalia, at www.ethnomarginalia.com to know more about how you can publish with us. We really look forward to hearing from you.
Before we proceed with this episode, we'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Ethnography Incubator at the University of Chicago and the Lozano Long Institute for Latin American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin.
And on that note, let's begin.
Excited today to be joined by Alexandros Plasatis, our very first novelist ethnographer guest. Alexandros is an immigrant from Greece living in the UK who writes fiction in English, his second language. He's just published the excellent book Made by Sea and Wood in Darkness, which is based on fieldwork he did primarily with Egyptian fishermen immigrants in a Greek cafe. Alexandros, thank you so much for joining us. And first of all, a big congratulations on your first novel.
Thank you very much, Alex. And thank you very much, Sneha, for having me here. Made by Sea and Wood in Darkness. So this is like a novel in stories, and it started. The whole project started about 20 years ago when I was studying social anthropology, and I did participant observation on the lives of the Egyptian immigrants who work as fishermen on the trawlers in Greece, and I had no intention of writing fiction. I never wrote fiction. Fiction was something that, you know, I had no interest in. Later on, though, about 5 years after I finished my undergraduate degree, I decided to go for fiction. And it took me quite a long time because I did it in my second language. And when I was starting writing fiction, my English was even worse than what it is now, you know? So finally I did it, and that's it. It's out now by Spuit and Duivel. It's an American indie publisher. And I'm here to talk with you about it.
And we did. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say thank you again. Thank you for having me here, you know, and talking about something that, you know, talking about, I haven't talked about ethnography for, you know, because I left it when I stopped doing, when I got my degree, then I just, I didn't deal with social anthropology, ethnography, and it's nice to go back after a very, very long time, you know?
Well, it's clear, you know, because you just published this wonderful book. That's very heavily based on ethnographic work. It's clear that you've still been, you know, thinking about the work that you did. So maybe we can start there. And particularly, you have a field site that most of the book takes place in, Cafe Papaya, which I think is based on your family's cafe. And you did really extensive ethnographic field work as a waiter in the cafe. And I think if I understood correctly, this was intentional. You were studying anthropology at the time and you were, you know, thinking of this as ethnographic field work, toward your studies. So starting in that moment, which I think you said maybe was like almost 20 years ago, what did you set out to research, and how did the cafe come to you as a field site?
Yeah, I started what I was researching, you know, officially, you know, as doing my participant observation and doing my dissertation on these people. So I was looking for, you know, the Egyptian fishermen. They were, you know, Muslims. So I was looking at how they can practice the religion in Greece. There is no mosque in Kavala. I was looking at their employment conditions because some of them were working, you know, without papers. I was looking at issues of marginality, why the locals, you know, they don't befriend them, why they stay outside of the mainstream society. I was looking to see how they maintain relationship with their families back in Egypt. So we are talking, this Egyptian community, we are talking about men only. You know, they were people who came from a specific area in Egypt. 90% of them came from a fishing village. That's how they call it. It's called Esbitelburg, and it's near Domiata. And they came to work particularly in the trawlers. And this is a tradition that goes back to the late 70s when Greeks sort of didn't want to work as fishermen anymore. And the fishing industry was struggling to find people. Then Greece and Egypt signed a bilateral treatment and a bilateral agreement. And then these people started to come over. But this is on paper what I was looking for. You know, this is, you know, I had some questions in mind to ask them. But if you ask me now what I was really looking for, I was looking for me to find understanding, for me to be able to understand, to be understood by other people, because I felt as an outsider in my town. Sorry. I felt that I couldn't fit. I didn't like the things that were happening in my town. And I wanted to find peace inside me. I wanted to know that there are people who understand me and that I understand people. And I think, although I had always the questions in mind, what I was really looking for was heart. You know, I wanted to feel understood by people. So the reason I went for my family's cafe is because I started working there since I was very, very little, about 11 years old. I used to work in the summers as, you know, I used to, my first job was to change the ashtrays, you know, just change the ashtrays and then, you know, and then to wash the glasses. And then I started working as a waiter. And the cafe is just opposite the fishing harbor. So, and it's an old cafe, and it's where the Egyptians and the Greek captains always came. You know, that was where they were. You know, this is where they spend their time. It was just, it was open 24 hours. You know, I could work any shift I wanted. I had to work, you know. So it was just, for me, the obvious place to do my field work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. That was very beautiful, especially what you said about finding understanding and looking for, and almost thinking about the heart and its place in ethnographic work. I felt like I could relate to a lot of what you were saying. And yeah, thanks for that. So getting into the novel more directly, so the book does a wonderful job of taking us inside the world of this cafe, but for those who haven't read it, could you describe a typical night at the cafe, and how did you juggle the twin demands of waiting and fieldwork?
Yeah, the cafe, I worked every shift. I worked the morning shifts, the evening shifts, and the night shifts. The cafe was a very weird cafe because it had the menu was like 20-30 pages. You know, we served everything.
Wow.
The customers, you could get any sort of customers. You could get, you know, the pensioners that wake up like 6 o'clock in the morning and they come to drink their coffee. And when they come, you have the girls, you know, from the strip clubs that finish their shift and they come to have something to eat. It was the nights were particularly hard because, and they were also sweet because at night they were sweet because you had the loners, the people who came because they needed company, and they would come and maybe have one beer and stay, you know, for 2 hours just because they needed to be around people. But also you had people who came after the clubs and the bars closed, and they were just drunk, you know, and they were very demanding, and they would cause problems. And you would have people who work, you know, those who sell protection in clubs, you know, sort of mafia people, you know, and they just wanted you to treat them as kings. So usually it was quiet between midnight and 2 o'clock in the morning. And then after 3 o'clock, we would start to get more people. And the way we worked, it was one person in the kitchen doing the cooking, and then it was just me outside serving and preparing coffees and you know, cleaning up. So you would get the people from the clubs. You would have the fishermen coming back from the fishing journeys at about 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning. And then at around 7 o'clock, you could get the pensioners. Comparing to the, you know, restaurants and cafes in England that I know, there was more freedom there. You know, you could sit down with the customer, you could have a drink, there was no problem. You could smoke inside, you could sit down with the customers and have a smoke. So you could have, you could talk with people. It was bittersweet. The sweetness came from those who needed company, and the bitterness came from those who demanded attention, and they wanted to show that they are better than you.
That's expressed really well in the book. And you mentioned some of this earlier when you were talking about sort of your own personal motivations for this project, but there is sort of a divide expressed through the main narrator, not the only narrator, but a waiter called Pavlo, who mm-hmm. is you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sort of he's very explicit that he prefers the marginalized people here, be they Egyptian fishermen, prostitutes, beggars, the people who you just said who sort of come and want to talk, rather than the local people who I guess are the demanding customers, who are often rude, as we see. So it's clear that these are the stories that interest you and the people that you and Pavlo, or you, Pavlo through you, or you through Pavlo, identify with much more than the Greeks themselves. Why do you think that is?
I couldn't. It was when we talk about the locals, the people that Pavlo doesn't like, we are talking about people that only by the way of looking at you, they are telling you that they are better than you. They have a need to show that they are superior. It's the way they give their orders, you know, when they want food. It's there was arrogance in these people, which I didn't like. These people needed to feel important, but the way they did it was by pushing you to make them feel important, to see in your eyes their importance. And I couldn't do it, you know. I couldn't understand why they were treating me this way. And not only me, you know, other people as well. On the other hand, you know, you had the Egyptians who were coming in the cafe. You had the beggars. You had the prostitutes. When they were coming in, I was feeling secure. You know, I was feeling, you know, these people love me, you know, and I love them. They were people who lack love, you know, the people who were treated unfairly all the time. And when, you know, I saw them as equals, you know, we it clicked. Regarding the locals, I tried to like them, you know, and I was thinking for a long time that there is something wrong with me because I cannot identify with them. I cannot have fun with them, you know. For many years, I was thinking that I'm in the wrong, you know, there is something wrong with me. So what I remember for one period, I used to drink and work a little bit drunk, sometimes quite a bit drunk, so that I could test myself, see, you know, what's wrong, you know. So I started entering their world, the world of the locals. And when I entered, you know, I was listening to what they were talking about, and it was just boring, you know. I just found everything boring, and I thought, is this how you are having fun, you know? And on the other hand, the Egyptians, they protected me, you know. In the cafe at nights, there were fights. There were people who were carrying guns. There were people who wanted to fight, and whenever there were Egyptians there, I felt secure because they told me, Alex, whatever happens, you know, we are here and we will fight for you. And we will fight until, you know, until we die, you know. And they never had to fight for me. But only knowing that there is someone there who understands me, you know, I felt nice. So that's why I identify more with these people. You know, the prostitutes, yeah? Okay. So I would have a table of, say, 8 people, okay? And say 4 men, four women who were sex workers, okay? Whenever I went to take the order, the men, they were treating me like a piece of dirt. And the women, the sex workers, would see, I could tell that they would see how I felt. And they could see that there was a tension between me and the other guys, you know, the men. And they, in their sweet way, protected me by making jokes, you know, by calming the guys down. Because, you know, as a waiter, you can take it, you know, 1, 2, 3, 20, 30 times, but there might be one time that you will snap, you know, because you had enough. But these women, they always made me feel good, and they calmed the situation down. And then the beggars, you know, the beggars would come, and I would feel in peace, because here is someone who I can talk with, you know. Here, I'll give you a plate of food, you know, and he would appreciate it, you know. And then, you know, we would make jokes, and he would tell me about his life, you know. So yeah, this is why I identify more with the marginalized people.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah, thank you. That was a very insightful response to the question, and it made a lot of sense the way you laid it out. So shifting gears a little bit, I wanted to ask you about your choices about writing this material the way you did. So you studied anthropology as an undergraduate before doing a PhD in creative writing, which clearly is still based on ethnographic methods and sensibilities. So why did you switch to creative writing rather than, you know, rendering all of this material in a much more traditional ethnographic manner? What was your motivation behind this choice?
There were two things. One thing is that I knew that I'm not a good anthropologist when it goes to theory. I didn't get theory. You know, I loved participant observation, but theory, maybe because at that time my English was not very good, you know, I just couldn't get it. You know, I had all this material and I just didn't know what to do with it. I had I had written 1,000 pages of, you know, my diaries about the Egyptian fishermen were 1,100 pages. And I just didn't know what to do. And the other thing is that when I read anthropology, when I read ethnography, I found it, I found the writing very dry. You know, mm-hmm. it was like I was eating, you know, boiled chicken fillet, you know, that, you know, you can hardly swallow, you know, it's good. It has protein, you know, but, you know, you need a bit of sauce, you need a bit of salt, you know, you cannot have it every day. Maybe because I'm not white, you know, maybe there is ethnography out there that is nice and juicy, you know, but I, you know, at that time I hadn't come across. So when I finished, I wanted to do a master's, but I knew that I'm not good in anthropology. And then I was talking with a friend who happened to read my diaries. And he told me, Alex, this, you know, I've read your diaries, you know, these are like short stories, you know. Why don't you go to do a master's in creative writing? And I said, no. He said, why not? Because, you know, I thought the writers, you know, I thought of people who put the scarf outside, you know, you know, they wear a coat and they put the scarf outside the coat and, you know, they have the hair, you know, weird haircuts. And I didn't want to be like that. And, but, you know, my friend insisted, I thought about it. And you know, to be honest, I didn't have many choices. I, you know, my first degree in social anthropology, I didn't do very well. And I thought that no university will accept me in anything, you know. And then I said, okay, I'll apply for creative writing. And one university accepted me. And then I did my master's and I did a lot better than I did in creative writing. And also, you know, between ethnography and, you know, ethnography is more like, you have to be in academia to be an ethnographer. Mm-hmm. To be a writer, you don't necessarily have to be in academia. Academia scared me a bit, you know, and the way people talk in academia scared me because, you know, they are very knowledgeable and I was not, you know. They act in a way that I didn't feel comfortable. While, you know, being a writer is like, being, you know, in the pub all the time, in a sense, you know. that's why I went for writing, and I'm enjoying it so far.
You know, a lot of what you said is so relatable to me that now I'm thinking that maybe I should switch to writing ethnographic fiction.
Go for it, Sneha. Yeah.
I think you're right. Just have to embrace this.
This is a dangerous message, but I love the metaphor of the dry chicken fillet. But
absolutely, it's like it's unforgettable. I'm always going to think of ethnography whenever I see a chicken fillet now.
But yeah, no, honestly, that's part of the reason we were really excited to have you on is. We said this to you before starting the interview, but to borrow your words, both Sneha and I are very interested in sort of figuring out how to make ethnography juicier in those ways, and borrowing elements from novels like yours. So you've done a little role reversal, right, because as an ethnographer, you were a local who did not necessarily identify very much with the locals in your Greek town. But as ethnographer, you are a local studying immigrants. Now you are yourself an immigrant living in England. So how do you think, or did they, how did your experiences as an immigrant that came sort of after the ethnography, or I guess even during the ethnography you were studying in England, but how did your own experiences as an immigrant inform your writing or affect sort of your interest in the topic?
By being an immigrant and by learning a new language, English, and by writing in a new language, the most obvious way that this affected me is that I know exactly how the Egyptian immigrants were feeling when they were talking to me in Greek, because Greek was their second language. You know, their first language was Arabic. So when I wrote stories about the Egyptians, when I wrote stories about the Egyptians talking to me in Greek and then I'm writing them in English, so I knew how the Egyptian would express himself in English, because I've been through different stages of, you know, when I came here, I spoke very little English, then I spoke a little bit more, and now I'm speaking so-so. So I knew how these people, what they wanted to say and how they felt when they were saying it. And, you know, the metaphors that they might use, you know, that they are not, they were not metaphors that we would use in Greek. And they are not metaphors, now that I'm writing in English, that English people or American people might use. Also, being an immigrant, you know, now being an immigrant is... I am an immigrant partly because of my Egyptian friends, because of how I was feeling in Greece and how I saw them feeling in Greece. I moved a country and I wrote in a different language as a statement, you know, that, okay, you know, Greeks, you piss me off, you know, fair enough. You know, I'll write it in English, you know. And now when I'm here with other immigrants or with refugees, it's just, you know, when we talk with each other, you know, from any country, I just pick up things and they pick up things from me. And it's easier, it's a lot easier to communicate. And it's a lot easier for me to enter the world of other immigrants and of refugees and to have fun with them and being in a way more equal. Because if we say that in Greece I was a local, and the Egyptians were, you know, a bit weaker because they didn't know the culture, they didn't know the language, you know. Now here, you know, we are equals. My life in the UK revolves around refugees and around immigrants, and So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but there you go.
No, very, very much so. And that sensibility definitely shines through in the writing. So we wanted to ask you as well, you were kind enough to share just a really interesting article that you wrote called The Good Waiter's Guide in Search of Morsels of Magic, Turning Ethnography into Fiction. And in this article, you draw on a metaphor from the novelist John Fante, who talks about writing as swimming in the ocean and trying to find a current that lets you know you're on the right track. So to quote from the article, you write, "By building rapport through ethnography, what actually happens later, when sitting down to write fictionally about the real people who have been studied and take, creatively, their point of view, is this sense of being in the sea and having the right current moving in the right direction. So I absolutely love this metaphor, and it seemed like a really powerful description of how ethnography can be valuable to fiction writers, even beyond sort of the, you know, learning or experiencing specific stories. Could you say more about what you mean by the sense of writing as finding a current, and maybe with, you know, examples from your own writing? How was your ethnographic research important to help you identify the right direction?
The ethnographic research, you know, with Egyptian fishermen, I spent thousands of hours together. I saw them in different circumstances. I saw them sober drinking coffee. I saw them, you know, being out together in bars. I saw them drunk. I saw them stoned. I saw them sad. I saw them very angry, you know, and equally they saw me in different situations. And when they saw me, I saw how I saw my reflection in them. So the ethnography, it gives you this spherical picture, you know. You know each corner of someone's character because you spend so much time with the people. So this, I'll give you an example. There is one of the stories in the book, which is called The Story with Yulia Has a Bad Ending. So when the Egyptian man was telling me this story, he had reasons not to tell me parts of the story. Even though I would pressure him a bit, because out of curiosity, I want to know what happened, you know, how you did this, how you did that, but he wouldn't. So later on, when I wanted to write this story, you know, I had to be him. I had to find out what happened, but not as me and not as him, because in the story, it's not, you know, when you write fictionally, you don't take a real person and you put him or her in a real situation. You take a real person and you put them in an unreal situation, a fictionalized situation. So you have to know how this person will act under certain circumstances, you know? And then it's some sort of a dance between you when you write and the real person that you have researched and you've spent time with. So in this story, there were lots of blanks. There were lots of gaps that I had as a writer to cover and to create in order to create the story. So I would try one thing, you know, and I could feel it, that it doesn't, you know, no, we are not here, Alex. No. What are you doing now? It doesn't feel good, you know. Try, move, you know, go swim, you know, swim around, see how it feels, you know. And then as you swim, you feel this thing comes to you, you know, and it pushes you in one direction. And then it's like a dance, you know, it's like two people are dancing, and then you feel that your movements are good, you know, and they match the movement of the fictionalized character. So this is an example, and the other thing with ethnography and the way I approached the participant observation, I went there to learn about their lives. So I was a student. They were my mentors, you know. They were the ones who were telling me what is right and what is wrong, how we do this, how we do that, you know, and I was learning. So by having them as mentors of their life, you learn how to do things in their way. And this again helps with the writing afterwards. It is they who are the artists, you know, not me. I am the observer of their art. You know, I'm there to watch the details, how they do things, how they drink coffee, how they hold the glass, you know, when they drink wine, how they walk, you know. It is they who show me the way and I follow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's, it was also reminding me of the kinds of things that I would try to remember to do in the field as an ethnographer, but that kind of eye for detail is I think really key to writing the way that you have, like so vividly. But what you said about them being the artists is a very interesting perspective, and I hadn't quite thought about it that way. So thanks for that. But you know, as you were saying all this, I was also wondering if you could recommend two or three novels to us that you see as really well-done examples of ethnographic fiction. I mean, other than your own, of course, but any other books that come to mind that we might want to pick up and learn a thing or two from?
There is, you know, you have Ernest Hemingway, you know, and mm-hmm. most of his work is, to me, is like ethnographic fiction. You have The Old Man mm-hmm. and the Sea, you know. Hemingway was a fisherman. He was a fisherman for years. You have For Whom the Bell Tolls, you know, when he went out there and in that book, you know, he uses Spanish and, you know, he shows the life inside the cave and, you know, how the fights were happening. And I think most of Hemingway's works are, to me, look like ethnographic fiction. And then on the other side, you know, you have Charles Bukowski. And mm-hmm. Bukowski's ethnography, you know, and he's, what he did, he researched, maybe he didn't see it as researching, but he researched the American lowlife, you know, and he wrote books about them. And if you follow his books, you'll see, you know, he starts from, you know, with a post office and his experiences there, and he takes you all the way to Hollywood. And he writes a novel about Hollywood, and it's all about the people that he's met. And one thing, you know, there is, for me, the purest, not ethnographic fiction, but ethnographic poetry that I've seen is by a Greek poet who is called Nikos Kavadias. That's Kavadias. And I think he's dead now. I think his books have been translated into English. I haven't read them in English. I don't know if the translation is good. But Kavadias was a sailor, and he wrote poetry about the people that he've met in the ships. And his poems are pure ethnography. You know, he shows you how the sailors pray. He talks about the brothels and where the sailors go, you know. So this is, for me, that was an inspiration. And this is also, it's because of Kavadias that I feel partly drawn to the margins. And there is, I also want to say about a song, which is by an English band. They are called Jethro Tull. And do you know them?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so they have a song, Aqualung, you know, which is about mm-hmm. the life of a beggar. And when I was in Greece, you know, I was listening to the song. I knew something was, I couldn't understand the lyrics, you know. I knew that something was happening. And then, you know, when I came to England, you know, I kept listening and listening and listening and tried to understand the lyrics. And Aqualung influenced me in the story that I wrote about my beggar, you know, the beggar who travels, that's in the book. So yeah, for me, these were some examples of ethnographic fiction.
Yeah, those are wonderful recommendations. Thank you. and kind of an eclectic mix. So yeah, we wanted to end by asking you about a couple projects, not necessarily your own writing, but work you do with immigrant and refugee writing. A couple of really cool projects, actually. So the first is you've done some sort of ongoing writing workshops with refugees there in England, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I'm not sure if it's connected or not, but you have a new project, or you're involved in a project called The Other Side of Hope, Journeys in Refugee and Immigrant Literature. So I was wondering if you could explain to us sort of what these initiatives are and why you think they're important and what your experience has been like in doing them.
Yeah, so the creative writing workshops with refugees, I used to do them when I was back in Leicester. I used to do them in City of Sanctuary. And I used to spend about 2 hours with the refugees who came to the drop-in center. And we would do creative writing workshops. This is how we call them, okay? But because they are creative writing workshops, so it's creative writing, okay? And basically it's fun. People should come to have fun because it's creative writing, you know? So we used to do, I did it for about 2 years, and we used to write little stories, little poems. We used to do group exercises. But we would start doing a creative writing workshop, and then someone would come with a massive tray of dolma, the rolled vine leaves with mince and rice, and say, come on, eat now, have a break, let's eat. So, okay, we would eat. Other people would bring cakes. And for them, because I think, when you are like me, because English is not my first language, for them it's easy to understand me. And for me, it's easier to explain things to them. So they feel more comfortable being with someone that they can identify a bit. So we did these workshops. We went out to poetry readings. They read their poems. A little book was published. And later on, I worked for a charity with who care for young unaccompanied asylum seekers, and I was living with these young people. My home was their home. I would get them straight off the lorries, and we called that house the new arrival house. And so I got to know the refugees a lot better. I lived there for 2 years, and sometimes we used to do writing exercises, and we used to do, this safe place. I don't know if you know about this, the safe place exercise. It's, this because these people are traumatized, and at nights they have they have nightmares. They can't sleep. They need to think of something safe to be able to calm down. So we would do creative writing exercises about their safe places, and they would write things, and then this continued, and the friendship, there was friendship with all the refugees that I've met. We still talk even now that I moved from Leicester, and we still have fun. And so in a way, do you want me to talk about The Other Side of Hope as well?
Yeah, it seemed like a very interesting initiative. Is it connected to this?
It is, in a way, it is connected, because what I saw, it is connected in a way that because I did these creative writing workshops, I felt very confident working with refugees and creative writing. So then I also saw the effect that the creative writing has on refugees. And I'm not talking about, you know, professional writers. I'm talking about people who may have never written any poetry or any story before, or they might not know what a poem is, you know. But I saw the effect this has on them, and I saw how proud they feel when they write something, and, you know, then they share it, you know, with their family, and they might send it back to the places where they came from. And the other side of hope, it's we start it now, and all the staff are immigrants and refugees, all the editors. And we accept poetry and fiction by refugees and immigrants only, because we want to give them a push, you know, we want to give them a platform. And because I know that it's not easy to write in your second language, I want this to be for them like a safe place where they can send stuff, and the stuff are received by people who understand them, you know, and that will make them feel comfortable whether we accept it or not. And then we have the other sections. We have nonfiction. You are very welcome to send us something, Sneha and Alex. We have creative ethnography. And we have the book reviews and the author interviews. And this is open to everyone as long as it's migration related. So I wanted this to be like a home for refugees and immigrants where they feel comfortable. And yes, one led to the other. Basically, the Egyptians, then my work with the Egyptians led to the creative writing workshops, and then the creative writing workshops led to the other side of hope.
Yeah. Thanks. That sounds really interesting. And I'll be sure to pass, you know, your email along to a lot of people that I know who might potentially be interested in contributing. I think it's such a wonderful initiative by you and your colleagues, and a welcome addition to the literary landscape in the world. And thanks a lot for doing that. And big thank you for taking time out to join us today and talk about your book and your novel. I'm so excited that it's out in the world, and we are sure that people who read it will benefit a lot from it, just like we did. And this conversation was such a fitting addendum to have read the book. And we're very excited to see all that you write and you mediate in the world. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Sneha, and thank you very much, Alex. And thank you for inviting me and giving me this opportunity to talk about something that happened, the ethnography, long time ago, and for being inclusive, because obviously, you know, I'm not an academic. I don't feel comfortable talking about, ethnography, but you made me feel, you know, comfortable. And even your emails before, when we were talking about this, and you told me it's going to be fun, you know, don't worry, you know, these things made me feel good. Thank you.
We are so glad. I mean, we are very honored that you could join us, honestly. I mean, I think we've had our fair share of academics on the podcast, and it's such a refreshing conversation to have with someone who, you know, who is like seeing it from another perspective at the very least. And but thanks again for such insightful takes on a lot of the questions and for engaging so generously with them. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, and this was a lot of fun, Alexandros. And I think both Sneha and I, and probably many of our listeners, are to at least some extent repressed novelists. and I think this podcast and you know, our website, Ethnographic Marginalia, to some extent express that or sort of come out of those feelings. So it was great to talk with a real novelist and ethnographer. And certainly gave both of us things to think about in terms of how to make our own writing more juicy. And I hope did so for our listeners as well. So thank you very much.